I had the opportunity to sit down with guest Jeff Deskovich. Jeff is an internationally recognized expert in wrongful convictions and founder of the Jeff Deskovich Foundation for Justice. Jeff spent 16 years in prison, wrongfully convicted of murder and rape before he was exonerated by DNA testing. H. Bosch Jr. with the Triple E segment of the show, Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. I'm going to dig right in. Jeff, tell us about your case. My first question is, describe how you were wrongfully convicted.
So I was arrested when I was 16. I was 17 by the time the trial rolled around. My wrongful conviction, which happened despite a pretrial negative DNA test result, was caused by a coerced false confession, prosecutorial misconduct, fraud by the medical examiner, terrible public defender, and added all up, I was wrongfully convicted of a murder and rape, which I did not commit, and ultimately I spent 16 years wrongfully imprisoned.
Wow.
Prior to being proven innocent through further DNA testing via the DNA data bank, which not only reaffirmed my innocence, but also identified the actual perpetrator, who was subsequently arrested and convicted. Super quickly, along the route of doing the 16 years, I lost 7 appeals and I got turned down for parole, despite being otherwise an ideal candidate, kind of what previous interview subject Cheryl Katz-Bentman spoke about, innocent people being denied parole due to maintaining their innocence, so kind of an overlap into my story. Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about readjusting to being released into society, and what challenges have you faced? I remember one particular story which was just blew my mind when you talked about you were so cautious that you were literally scared to walk across the street for jaywalking. So, you know, go ahead.
Yes.
Not to steal your thunder.
Not at all. Plenty of after effects to get into. No shortage of material. So in no particular order, the difficulty in adjusting, I mean, obviously there's going to be psychological after effects of being wrongfully imprisoned. So I did a lot of work with therapists dealing with PTSD, anxiety, panic attacks, feeling of being frozen in time, like feeling like I was 17 again, which was the last year I was free. So imagine feeling 17 when you're at 32, but mm-hmm. not in some fountain of youth, wonderful type of way, but instead
it took that whole period of your life.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So from that aspect to it, then, you know, social stigma. Okay, you were in prison wrongfully, yes, but you were in prison for 16 years. So how much of that rubbed off on you? Is it safe to have you around, be alone someplace with you? That's a psychological and social. But the other aspects to that, technology was different. Like, we didn't have Bosch. We did not have the internet. There was no cell phones.
You missed that
GPS. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I missed the natural
progression. The
actual progression of life. I mean, mm-hmm. I lost from 17 all the way up until 32.
Junior prom.
I didn't go. I didn't go to the prom. I didn't graduate high school. Births, deaths, weddings. Mm-hmm. Not being established in career. The culture was much different. So, between the culture and the technology, and then the physical change in neighborhoods I was familiar with, I mean, had the cumulative effect of making me feel like I was a fish out of water, that mm-hmm. I didn't quite belong here, that this wasn't my world. But yet I didn't belong in prison either because I was innocent. So, mm-hmm. you know, like
you
a man without a country, almost caught in the middle.
Right.
Neither fish nor
damn
fowl.
If you do, damn if you don't.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
So let me ask you this then. You became an advocate upon your release. Tell us why, and talk a little bit about your body of work. The bow.
Sure. So I became an advocate because I needed to take something out of the negative experience that happened to me. I needed to make my suffering count for something. So when I was released, I gave an off-the-cuff two-and-a-half-hour presentation to the media.
That was a real off-the-cuff.
Right. But everything I ever wanted to say in 16 years and could never get anyone to hear, it all came out. And just when I thought I was finishing up, another topic came to mind. So it was at that moment I realized that I could be part of the innocence movement without necessarily being a lawyer. So I embarked on this advocacy career. So some of the highlights, I've done maybe 100 presentations across the country. I became a weekly columnist. I did that for 5 years. Mm-hmm. I teamed up with New Yorkers Against the Death Penalty. We fought off capital punishment reinstatement efforts in 2007. Mm-hmm. So they introduced me to the world of lobbying and going to legislative hearings. And I made the decision early on to trade privacy in exchange for greater awareness, hence doing an ungodly amount of interviews.
You decided that your life mission was to serve.
Yes.
And my friend, you have done a phenomenal job.
And that's how I make sense of what happened to me in a kaleidoscopic type of way. I believe I am doing the work that I'm meant to do.
Pause. Get that word, kaleidoscopic. Go right there. So, all right, let me ask you this then. Tell us a little bit about the Jeff Deskovich Foundation.
Okay, so I was an individual advocate for about 5 years. And then I was finally financially compensated, and I reached a crossroads. You know, do I want to just continue to be just an individual advocate, or do I really want to ramp this thing up and take it to the next level? So I decided that I wanted to go to the next level. So I committed $1.5 million from the money I received, and I started the Jeffrey Deskovich Foundation for Justice, who would continue the awareness and policy work that I did as an individual advocate, but more importantly, do things I could never do as an individual. So specifically, I wanted to exonerate people. So in our 5 years of existence, we exonerated two people, William Lopez, who was in for 23.5 years, William Hawley. We got another four people out through alternative means, because it's not always able to prove with something new.
Okay.
And we had a hand in helping to pass some laws in Albany a couple of years ago.
So that leads me into my next question and asking you about some of the foundation more notable cases.
Yeah, sure. Well, William Hawley and I mentioned, and William Lopez. But I want to highlight some cases of other people who are currently wrongfully imprisoned, current clients that we believe will be exonerated. Yeah, definitely. Carolyn Warmus is one case. The same medical examiner who altered his testimony in my case, changed the time of death in hers. Mm-hmm. I want to highlight Andrew Krivak, who's been in for 18 years. The same polygraphist who coerced the false confession out of me did the same thing to Andy. Imagine being wrongfully imprisoned on a case where you have a co-defendant, and your co-defendant on the same set of facts, he's out and you're still in.
Wow.
That's his co-defendant, mm-hmm. Anthony DiPippo, in the National Registry of Exonerations, right. And yet his co-defendant's mm-hmm. still in. So I want to highlight that case, Hector Lopez, who Scarcella, the corrupt detective from Brooklyn, right, claimed that he confessed to him, right? There's a lot of cases where Scarcella's have been overturned, but yet from a scientific point of view, in an arson case, which I know you know all about.
Oh boy, am I all too familiar with arson.
So
that's a whole nother story for another time.
Right, yeah. But get a load of this, though. The arson expert says that from a scientific point of view, that the fire did not happen in the way in which Scarcella's claiming our client confessed. Yeah. So you know how that went.
Right. So let me ask you this real quick. Because you're world renowned. Are most of your cases just centered in New York State?
The bulk of them are in New York State, but an exception for that is we are able to do DNA cases nationally. That's more a situation of you can do it by remote control. It's really expensive to run an out-of-state non-DNA investigation. So a future aspiration would be to, kind of like borrowing off the ACLU model, would love to have a chapter in each state and eventually in every country, because you know what? Wrongful convictions is not a U.S. problem. It's a worldwide problem. We don't hear about that in other countries. You know why? Because the errors aren't corrected over there, and there's no one working to do it.
The late Dr. Martin Luther King said,
injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
How about that? So I want to cherry pick a little bit. So I want to tell us about going to school, college, in prison. What was that experience about?
Sure. So I was arrested when I was 16, as I shared earlier, which meant I didn't graduate high school, but I did get the GED while I was in prison. I was determined to minimize the loss that I was experiencing. Mm-hmm. So I obtained an associate's degree while in prison, and I completed an additional year of schooling towards the bachelor's. You know, I saw people that from being in the regular cell blocks to being housed in the prison college block, and I saw the transformative impact that the college education had. Mm-hmm. And it made me have to do that much less work. When I eventually was exonerated, I was further along. I wasn't starting from scratch in my formal education.
So you were smart, to realize education was going to be the key to you forwarding your life and doing it in a way where you could truly make a difference. Now, after the settlement then, I just think there should be a buildup, because I am so proud of you, man. how did law school come into play? And man, I can't say enough words about you, brother. You know, I told you, when you walk across that stage, you walk across there for me. You know you're standing on my shoulders and a whole lot of people. I might run up on the stage and just act a fool, so be prepared. Tell me about law school, all right?
Absolutely. So
phenomenal.
So when I was released, the Journal News, which is a daily newspaper in Westchester, they had as a human interest item in their story, along with my release and exoneration, that I was 10 classes short of a bachelor's degree. So Mercy College reached out to me on their own and gave me a full scholarship, so I finished the bachelor's degree in psychology. I tried to go to law school. I couldn't get in. The LSATs were really hard. And so not being able to do that, I instead decided to go to grad school, where I got a master's degree from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice with my thesis in wrongful conviction causes and reforms. And then I decided to go back again to pursue the dream. See, my dream growing up was to be a lawyer. My mother had a personal injury lawyer, and he was always well-dressed.
And
he seemed to be well-respected. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to keep pursuing that dream, but it was for a far different motivation. So I got into the Elizabeth Hobbs School of Law at Pace University, where I'm almost finished with my second year of law school out of three, in pursuit of my dream of exonerating more people only as a lawyer. I want to exonerate people as a lawyer. It's not enough anymore to sit in the front row, mm-hmm. where even though I might have brought the lawyer in, the lawyer might be working for me, I might have prepped him,
right.
but none, when
you
it's
want
time,
to be right in the
I can't sit at the desk, I can't talk to
You're
the judge.
You're actually going to have an
now
effect on people's lives.
I want to be direct. So to bring in an NFL football analogy, right? The Super Bowl just ended. Mm-hmm. I'm tired of being the head coach. Okay, I want to get in the game and play quarterback. I want to play quarterback.
Well said. So
I just wanted to share, you know, that it's really important to me, and I know you know this, but just for listeners that this may be the first time ever encountering me, I'm an advocate, and my motivation, my drive, is what happened to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not like what happened to me. There's a huge difference, and being recognized that way really means a lot to me. And I've been able to position myself in the middle, in which I don't compromise on justice issues, but I am understood that I'm against injustice. I'm not like anti-cop, anti-prosecutor. I'm anti-corrupt cop. I'm anti-rogue prosecutor or prosecutor that goes outside the
room. And that's the message we want to give out on the station. We're not anti-cop.
Right.
We're anti-bad cop. We got to end. We got to get you back here. But I
Absolutely.
Thank you, brother, for showing up, and I appreciate you gracing us with, you know, this interview and taking time out of your very, very busy schedule. Ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Deskovich, as I say, the incomparable Jeff Deskovich, world-renowned speaker. Till next time, folks, it's about the triple E's: education, empowerment, entrepreneurship. And remember this, don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez's Bosch. I always give a tribute to my mom. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy, H. Bosch Jr.
That was WOOC correspondent and host H. Bosch Jr. interviewing Jeffrey Deskovich, founder of the Jeffrey Deskovich Foundation for Justice.